In front of me, I can see high-rise apartment blocks, low-rise housing, suburban housing in the gardens, spreading out as far as the eye can see along the River Thames and around the Thames Basin. This is the view from the public viewing gallery, high up, in fact, on top of the Shard, London's tallest skyscraper. When we talk about architecture, we often do so with a capital A. We seem to mean these very grand, expensive, signature buildings. But what about these everyday buildings I can see sprawling far below me? The shops and offices and schools and houses. I mean, it's no mean feat to design and make buildings like this cloud-piercing Shard. But in this series, I'm going to explore how we've tried to shape architecture for everyone. So let's come down from the Olympian heights of this astonishing new building to the marketplace, to the streets, avenues, and cul-de-sacs far, far below.
Consortium developments thought they were big and powerful, and they thought might is right. But we have proved that right is mightier.
Yes.
In recent decades, the design and realisation of ordinary buildings in Britain has often been highly controversial.
They do not wish to see the whole of the southeast of England covered in bricks, mortar and tarmac.
Maybe this is the beginning of a sort of revolution against absolute desecration of our villages and our lifestyles.
For some people, the problem may simply be the very idea of new buildings springing up around them. Yet all too often, the architecture of those new buildings doesn't help.
Standardised, depersonalised, denatured dwelling units. These examples were taken at random in Yorkshire, Berkshire and Dorset, but they could be anywhere.
And today, new building is a still more urgent political issue. Year after year, the number of new households created outstrips the number of new homes built by about 100,000. And yet, people are unlikely to accept new buildings if they don't like the look of them. Labour and Conservatives seem to agree the appeal to our senses is often too low. Roberta Blackman-Woods, Shadow Planning Minister, and Minister for Architecture, Ed Vasey.
I think it is the biggest problem, and anyone like me, who represents a rural constituency, sees it very much at first hand, where a lot of housing development is being proposed and there's a lot of opposition. And I think a lot of it comes down to not people being NIMBYs, but a fear that the development will simply be dropped on top of them. So it won't be integrated within their communities. The buildings won't look like they are part of their community. They can be different from what has gone before, but they should have some kind of relationship.
My own constituency, a local architecture company, have just produced the most amazing primary school that I've ever seen in an ex-mining village in Eshwinning in rural County Durham. So we can get it right, but we probably need to do better as a rule, particularly in terms of housing design and in diversity of design.
Alex Morton of the centre-right think tank Policy Exchange argues that if we're going to see much more building in the next few years, making its design acceptable to local people is crucial.
Over 85% of people say that the built environment is very important to them, that they care about it in their area. 70% of people say the quality of what's built is more important than the amount of housing that's being built near them. So there's a real interest in, you know, what's being built in my backyard. The problem is, at the moment, the system takes that interest and channels it into NIMBYism, into antagonism. If you look at opinion polls, there's always a small minority who are against all development. But the vast majority of people say, if it comes with amenities, if it looks nice, if it pushes, you know, the value of my house up and the area up, I would support it. And that makes perfect sense.
Much of the real politics here takes place away from Westminster. At the front line in the battle for good quality architecture are local planners. So let's go and look at an example of volume house building begun around a decade ago to see what it tells us about the politics of our everyday architecture. This is Cathedral View to the west of Ely in Cambridgeshire. The advert in front of me says, Cathedral View, a stunning development of 1, 2, 3 and 4 bedroomed houses. And that indeed is what I can see around me. Whether they're stunning or not is another question, but what they are the new houses, pitched roof houses designed in a sort of semi-traditional styles. They stretch out around enormous great village greens, exaggerated village greens, under this huge Cambridgeshire sky. The houses vanish along winding, curving avenues as far as the eye can possibly see. It seems to me that whoever's designed this place hasn't really got Ely under their skin. It looks like housing that could be anywhere else in Britain.
We are looking at a row of houses that has gone up since I moved in here. So when I moved in, I had a lovely view across the fields, and then they plonked four houses in front of my windows, which is fine because they're very attractive houses. But yeah, they went up in no time. It was kind of like building IKEA furniture, just get it out the box and put it all together, and up they all went in identical fashion in record time.
I went to meet Tara in her three-storey, three-bedroomed house in the middle of Cathedral View and asked what she makes of it.
As a house, it works. On the whole, there are a couple of things that I think could be improved on. There's not enough living space. So, you know, bearing in mind that we're a family, we've got, you know, three children, you've got to kind of cram dining table and sofas and everything else into one room.
And what about the way it feels?
It feels lovely. I mean, it's nice. It was so nice to move into something that was completely new, you know, just a blank canvas, basically. You know, I can do what I want with it. It was all clean. It was all, and more importantly, it's all under guarantee.
And the way it looks?
The way it looks? I like the way it looks. Yeah. I think it's a well-proportioned and well-built house. I like it from the outside. I like it on the inside. It's got plenty of storage, which is, I gather, unusual in new houses.
Tell me about inside Cathedral View. Mm-hmm. Are there any shops or
no.
pubs or...?
No, there aren't. No. And that potentially needs to be addressed, I guess, because, I mean, even in the, you know, what, 18 months that I've been here, more houses are sort of spreading all around. I think they've nearly finished the development now. But, you know, we've got goodness knows how many people living here, and you're right, there isn't even a sort of a corner shop you have to go into town to get anything. There are also, there's no children's playground on the development.
If you had a choice, mm-hmm. would you live here in Cathedral View or in a townhouse in the old city of Ely?
For me, at this stage in my life now, on my own with three very small children, this is perfect because it's not like it's going to suddenly, you know, have a damp problem or need re-roofing or anything that goes with kind of old houses. It lacks character, but I think that will come. And I think as I put my own stamp on it, I'm gradually starting to kind of decorate. But, you know, I think when the kids are a bit older, I'd like to move, you know, somewhere a bit more historic. But, you know, these houses are affordable because they are the same. You know, it's just bish, bash, bosh, let's put up another one. I think once you got into trying to make them fit with existing architecture and trying to make them more aesthetically appealing and to match what was there, I think it would drive the price up, and that wouldn't work for a lot of families.
So how does this kind of thing happen? The decisions that shape our towns, suburbs and cities, building by building, are made not by globe-trotting star architects, but by men and women we rarely hear on radio. Council planners, project managers, developers. So I need to talk to them about the pressures and challenges they face, both creatively and financially.
The extension of West Ely and other parts of Ely, including the riverside, all happened in a period sort of mid-90s to early 2000s.
Men like the former South Cambridgeshire planning manager, Nigel McCurdy. To find out what happened with Cathedral View, I went to speak to him in a nearby development from the same period about the expansion of Ely from the 1990s onwards. As he explains, the planners did draw up design guides outlining the sort of Ely-esque style they wanted to see in developers' planning applications. Subtle details like distinctive types of Fenland windows. But how can council planners get developers who come offering anywhere architecture to accept local design guides?
One of the key learning points for us as officers was understanding that the developer product quite often was an awfully page product applied anywhere, with architects that we can't control, working out of Manchester or Birmingham, who actually in some instances had never been to Ely when they were putting the planning proposals together, which we found quite shocking. So one of the things we did was say, look, we want to have meetings with your architects on site so that they can see the character of what's around them and better interpret that in their professional capacity.
How much pressure can a council put on developers? I mean, because they can always walk away, can't they?
I remember one developer in the very early days saying, actually, if that's what the council wants to do here, we're not coming. We're going to walk away because we're not prepared to change your architecture, not prepared to change your layouts. We know what our customers want. We'll give them that. You've got it wrong. And we said to them, well, we're sorry. If that's what you want to do, then please walk away. because your product's not good enough as far as the council's concerned. That developer stayed and built one of the early phases, and that developer came to me later days and said, actually, have you got any more land? Because they realised, having done it the way we wanted them to do it, it actually created a more premium product. He sold it very quickly and very easily and said, oh, can I do that again?
So sometimes it does work, as in the West Ely development, where Nigel and I met, with streets and houses that share, if a little self-consciously, something of the historic spirit of Fenland design. But why didn't the same insistence on distinctive local design apply in Cathedral View?
I think Cathedral View in concept was the same as West Ely, in terms of needing to get a green edge, needing to link to the school facilities, which are literally right next door to that development, and have that same palette of materials and colours. So the work I was involved in before I left the council was to reapply those principles in the design guide to that allocation as well, and to set it up properly in terms of the broad master plan layout, the areas of development as opposed to open space. The architecture is a bit different. I can't comment on that because that was after I was elsewhere. But I think the principles were there, and I think that's really the role for the council and the developer moving forward, is, yes, get the master plans right, get the principles right, but pay a lot of attention at the same time to the detail, because the devil's in the detail, as they say. And I think Cathedral View, maybe some of that got lost in interpretation.
Cathedral View was built by one of the biggest volume house builders, Barratt Homes. In 2006, Mark Clare became the company's chief executive.
Cathedral View was actually started 12 years ago. I mean, it's just coming to an end now. It was built against a planning regime where density was the main requirement, PPG3. So we actually had to build more density. Obviously, the house types there are very, very different to what we build today. And we weren't using the design council's building for life then. So I think if we were building that again today, it would be quite different. I mean, the interesting thing about Cathedral View is that the feedback from customers is reasonably good. It's not, you know, it's not the best development that we've ever built, but it's reasonably good, both the design and the layout of the scheme. But I can honestly say that today, if we were building in that location, 500 homes, so quite a big site, then there would be a lot more variety, very, very different designs of the houses. But actually, the setting would be completely different. And you know, the reality is that that would deliver a much better proposition for us as a company than what we would have done in 2001.
We'll come back to exactly how Barratt has been changing its approach later. But meanwhile, our British landscape is increasingly thick with glum supermarket sheds, anywhere houses in standard issue cul-de-sacs, buildings in which inspiring architecture is not exactly the top priority. What on earth, or in Britain, happened? Well, one change is that architects themselves have lost power over the building process. Yet once they were kings and queens of all they surveyed.
There are 36 building years left to the 21st century. One generation in which to recreate the world around us.
I saw the possibilities of replacing these with towers of flats on the hilltops. We must plan comprehensively and get on with the plans as fast as we possibly can.
Projects were centred around the personality of the architect.
Robert Lombardelli has been running a project management company since the early 1980s and recalls the control architects used to have.
Architects ran the contract. Contractors would have to implement those designs produced by the architect.
This was all very well until architects, or the clients they were working for, started making changes along the way, either through indecision or aesthetic inspiration.
If the contract drawings were not complete, that would open up areas of dispute. And that's where you get the conflict between the architect and the contractor. And very often the project would run into delay or over budget because of those conflicts. Because of these cost and time overruns, there had to be another mechanism by which the projects could be brought under control.
The works of those patrician architects were by no means always successful. And even when they were, it was sometimes at the price of ballooning costs.
And so since the 1980s, architects themselves have paid a heavy price. A new method called design and build, a way of bringing contracts under control for simple buildings, gave the contractor, rather than the architect, overall responsibility for design as well as construction. Contractors might hire an architect to produce drawings, but increasingly the contractor, and more particularly the project manager, was in control. And now it's true, cost overruns seem to occur rather less often than they once did.
That may be because the architects are concentrating on what they're good at, which is design, and leaving the management to the project managers, who are professional managers. You can't throw money at a project now. Time and cost are everything. And if you can build in quality and a design, the aesthetic, into that as well, then you gain all the way around. So it's not remarkable anymore that we can build things to time and to a reasonable quality and to budget.
Today, a highly experienced project manager like Bob Lombardelli can doubtless deliver good quality buildings through this new method. But will it always work? By solving the cost problem, have we left ourselves with an architectural one if cost becomes too overriding a concern? In one of the echoing concrete halls of the University of Bath School of Architecture, Alex Wright, Professor of Architectural Design, told me how he worries that architects have been too severely squeezed out of the construction process.
I think there's a level of frustration from an architect that they might become involved in a project after certain decisions have been made, which they, from their perspective, would regard as being very questionable, and then their involvement in the project is effectively terminated before they have the opportunity of ensuring the quality of the final built artefact in its finished detail. And I think that's partly the reason why some of the buildings we see today are maybe not as effective as they could be. And it's a surprising number of projects which actually go forward without any architectural involvement at all.
Which raises the question of who the architecture is for. Clients and owners, the people who live in it, or anyone who sees it, particularly those who live nearby. One of our leading architects, Sir Terry Farrell, who designed the MI6 headquarters overlooking the Thames and the new Home Office in Westminster, was a young architect, not least at the London County Council, in the glory days of the profession. So does he regret their passing?
I think I would not like to go back to that view of the architect that existed in the 50s, 60s, indeed the 70s. I worked at the LCC for only 6 months, but it gave me a very distinct picture of top-down. I don't live this way, but I think it's the best way for the masses to live. It was the days of most of the buildings and the LCC, and indeed in most of the profession, were for the welfare state. And even then, as a young man, I was shocked by the way that flats and high-rises and estates were built. I think I was influenced by the fact I grew up in a housing estate.
So perhaps the architect's job is no longer to build in any way for their own creative fulfilment, but in a purely matter-of-fact manner for the people who use their designs. But how do people as a whole want new buildings to look, and at what cost? John Stewart of the House Builders Federation argues that what most of us want is traditional design.
People in this country are fairly conservative. They like what architects are often very disparaging about. It's mop this or mop that. And so if you would send an architect in, they will probably say, oh, that's dreadful, you know, that doesn't meet anyone's requirements. Whereas the local people, that's really what they want. They have a fairly traditional approach.
But then remember Tara from Cathedral View, who thought designing homes to fit the local area would make them unaffordable. The paradox is that people want homes that look and feel traditional and local, but that are also affordable. This conversation often ends up being about applied visual styles of architecture, traditional versus modern, and little else. Yet there's something we easily miss here. The telltale divide between low cost and loving tradition is there in the very building blocks of the process. Come with me to a side street in North London, and I'll show you what I mean. I've come to a brick reclamation yard to have a look at the kind of bricks we use to build our homes today. They're black bricks, blue bricks, purple bricks. They're yellow bricks, orange bricks, red bricks. It's a lovely palette of colours. But the bricks divide clearly into two types. There's the warm, handmade bricks, like the London Stock Brick. which is, you can pick it up, it fits in your hand. This is the sort of brick people have made, really, for thousands and thousands of years. In fact, since architecture began. And this brick, which I pick up, oh, it weighs a lot more. It's solid. This is industrial brick, which were originally used for creating Victorian chimneys. They were used in sewers, they were used in railway viaducts. But from the mid-20th century, they were also used in housing. So let's see if I can give you a sense of the difference between these two bricks, the soft handmade and the hard industrial brick, by a simple test on the radio, which is to take a heavy, hard hammer from the brickyard and to give it a bash. This is the soft handmade brick. My hammer just cracked it straight in half with one not very hard blow. And look inside, it's lovely, the soft, crumbly texture, almost like a good English cheese. I can peel layers off my fingers now. Part two of the test is the hard red industrial brick. Wow! It breaks, but it just snaps in two. The texture of the brick, the chemical makeup of it, means it's really tough. One of the big differences about these two types of bricks is the way they age. The soft London stock brick ages very gently and gracefully. The weather will gradually erode the brick to give it this soft look, whilst the industrial brick, which is hard as anything, the texture is smooth, so it will always look new, even after 100 years. So it's no good building a traditional-looking house if it doesn't age well. Looking comfortably old costs a bit more money. However, one thing I've been surprised to discover in the course of this series is that there are signs that some of the volume builders, and even supermarket chains, are asking architects to help them square this circle, to marry standard, contemporary designs with local materials that will age with time.
We're stood outside our new Hardwick store, 70,000 square foot store. Which
I went to the edge of King's Lynn in Norfolk to meet James Cameron, in-house architectural consultant for Sainsbury's, and Bruno Moore, the company's planning manager at one of their newest supermarkets. It's an example of what they call their new store architecture, designed by, yes, architects. It's set among a rough and ready scrum of older stores, which may not have been troubled by an architect at all.
It's pretty large by our standards.
And James, what we see is a very, very large building indeed, and I can see straight away it's got some quite subtle differences compared to the everyday supermarket people might expect, which are usually big tin boxes or big brick boxes.
It's a timber frame building, which gives it a lightness internally.
Will that weather? Will that age? We've certainly got lots of weather here in us in Norfolk.
Yes, this timber is natural timber. It will weather with time. It'll go from its rich timber red colour now. It'll dull down and go to a very lovely grey colour, probably in about 5 to 6 years' time.
What is it that's different from what you've done before?
Yes, you can design for a shed, as people have done before when designing supermarkets. But here we've used possibly a rather flowery term, but we've called it a pavilion. So there are overhanging eaves around the two sides of the building, a large canopy to the front, the clear story glazing, which runs around the front and the sides, bringing natural daylight into the store. And the panels allow us to apply the materials from the locality into this location or any other location.
We've got a site currently in build at Weymouth, down in Dorset, and it's in the local authority of Weymouth and Portland. So clearly we're using Portland stone with regards to cladding the building, because that's a very strong local material that we're incorporating into the design, despite the fact it's a similar out-of-centre development such as this.
It's very interesting when you look into the shop from the lobby, is that the ceilings are very high. I mean, you're looking right up to the roof space, and it's very tall and airy.
You've got a mezzanine space in it, so the building is built to accommodate that height. It is about 7.5-8 metres to the underside of the eaves, which gives it a lovely spacious quality. And again, you'll get there's an awful lot of timber that you can see in the ceiling, but that gives it a softness to the environment and a warmth that you wouldn't have achieved if it had been white steel.
Previous generations of food store architecture, they used to have suspended ceilings in them, and so very, very low. But by removing that, you get a much more light and airy feel. But there's also a very practical
spin-off of that, which is you can then light the store from above with roof lights in the roof, so you're not reliant so heavily on electric lighting within the store.
James, in earlier supermarkets, centre these very low ceilings, quite claustrophobic. But why did that happen?
I think it was led by the fact that the amount of Dutch work and air conditioning and electrics and everything that went up into the ceiling needed to be hidden by removing the ceilings and creating that additional height. It means that we have to, and our engineers have to, consider the designs of where their electrical conduits are running, the lighting and the air conditioning, so that we can produce an uncluttered ceiling space that then has the benefit of having the daylight.
And remember that Barratt Homes development we visited in Ely at the start of the programme, Cathedral View? Since becoming chief executive, Mark Clare has insisted that Barratt adopt something called Building for Life, a set of 12 design principles drawn up by the Design Council, which the house builder now applies to all its new developments, like a new scheme in the East End of London, St Andrews. So what would Cathedral View be like if it was built now?
You'd start with a piece of land that you're buying. You'd look at all the existing features of that land. You'd say, well, what can we use? I mean, if there are trees, water features, or anything of note, then the first thing you do is say, right, we're going to build the houses around that. We're not going to concrete over that. We want to actually capture those. You would use the Design Council's code to make sure that what you're delivering is the right variety of homes for local people. You'd be trying to make sure you integrated it into the local environment. I mean, the Cathedral View is quite a big development in a small village. So in that respect, it's quite challenging. You'd be wanting to try and make sure that you linked it up with the existing development. I mean, you'd look at things like facilities on the site because, I think in 2001, you could build 500 homes with no facilities. Today, St Andrews is a good example. We have, a shop on the site. We have a PCT on the site. We have other facilities. And so I think for big sites, you'd really want to have, different elements. And you probably want three or four quite distinct areas on a cathedral. They'd actually look quite different. The thing that always surprises me is the difference between a development that we built maybe 5 or 6 years ago and one that we're building today. It sounds like quite subtle changes that we've made in terms of the house design and the layout, but it actually creates a very, very different environment to live in. And that's what we're trying to capture because, when buyers come to our sites, we want them to go, wow. Not just for the first year as they've moved into a brand new shiny house, but to actually say, this is a nice place to live. It's a community we've created rather than just a whole load of houses built in an open space.
In our next programme, I visit one such new scheme to see how developers are putting all this into action. Could it be part of a quiet revolution in British architecture? A slow rediscovery not just of better building design, but of the art of making places we might all truly wish to live in.
The Politics of Architecture was presented by Jonathan Glancy, and the programme was produced by Phil Tinline.